Hello and welcome back to Franklin Covey's twice weekly podcast on leadership with Scott Miller. That's me. I'm your host of this twice weekly podcast series that we release on Tuesdays and Fridays, both video and audio episodes, where each week we interview guests with the intention of making you a better leader. Sometimes they are Fortune 50 CEOs. Other times they're iconic entrepreneurs. Oftentimes they are researchers, academics, perhaps people that have suffered, in some cases, an unspeakable tragedy or loss and lived to tell about it. And sometimes they are people that might be experts in leadership, marketing, culture, process, execution, strategy, you name it, kind of normal, important business topics. The point is, we try to shine what is Franklin Covey's mega bright spotlight onto people that will make you a better leader, including a better partner, human, parent, or just friend as well. Today, I have the New York Times bestselling author, this iconic journalist, researcher. You know him as Sebastian Younger. He, of course, wrote the iconic book, The Perfect Storm, amongst many other books. He's won the Peabody. His books have become movies that have been nominated for Academy Awards. His research as a journalist has churned out riveting books of time of war, Middle East conflict, and I'm privileged today to be in possession of his forthcoming book, releasing shortly on May 21st, called In My Time of Dying. The tagline is how I came face to face with the idea of an afterlife. The book is being released in digital audio and hardcover. I'm privileged to have a copy of it in soft cover as a galley copy. Sebastian Younger, welcome to On Leadership.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. You are known around the world for a variety of harrowing efforts. For many people, they know you as the author of the iconic book, The Perfect Storm. You are, I think, best known to me from your articles in Vanity Fair that I have followed for many years. You are, of course, a war correspondent and journalist. You have a broad range of contributions to the literary world. But before we get into your most recent release, In My Time of Dying, Sebastian, would you rewind and maybe reorient all of our listeners and viewers around the world to who you are, how you got started, what some of your more well-known works are, and then we'll get into this riveting journey that you most recently faced.
Thank you. So in my 20s, I decided I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to be a journalist, a freelance journalist. Which is a slippery slope and a steep hill to climb. And I couldn't make a living at it. I wound up working as a climber for tree companies. I would work 50, 60, 100 feet in the air on a rope with a chainsaw, taking trees down in sections if they were in a small space and couldn't just be dropped from the ground. And it's dangerous work. And I got hurt. I hit my leg with the chainsaw and tore open the back of my leg. And as I was recovering, I thought, maybe I'll try writing a book about dangerous jobs. I was living in the town of Gloucester, Massachusetts, a fishing town, and a huge storm hit while I was recovering from my wound, and a local boat named the Andrea Gale was sunk off the Grand Banks with six men. And so I did a deep dive on that. It was going to be part of a book on dangerous jobs that I envisioned. It became its own book. It became The Perfect Storm. But I'd been in Sarajevo during the siege in 1993, and I became enamored of the idea of being a war reporter. And so I wrote a book proposal and then went back to Bosnia to report on the war. And after my book came out, as soon as I could, I went back to war reporting. I was in Afghanistan in the 90s, 1996. And then again in 2000, I was in Kosovo. I was in West Africa, the civil wars in West Africa. And between these journalistic trips, I continued writing books on a variety of topics. Eventually, I was with American forces in Zabul province and then Kunar province in 2007, 2008. I documented one platoon in combat for an entire year on this remote outpost called Restrepo, named after the platoon medic who'd been killed at the base of that hill, basically. So I was with them off and on for a year, and I wrote a book called War, and I shot a lot of video. My partner and I shot a lot of video, and we directed and produced the documentary film Restrepo, which went on to win the Sundance Grand Jury Prize and to be nominated for an Oscar. And a few years later, my colleague, Tim Hetherington, who I'd been at Restrepo with, was killed in combat in Libya during the Arab Spring on an assignment I was supposed to be with him on. We were supposed to go there together. At the last minute, I couldn't. He caught some shrapnel in his groin from a mortar, and he bled out in the back of a rebel pickup truck. And I decided I'd taken enough chances. I'd almost been killed several times that I knew of. I thought, I'm going to get out. I saw what his death did to everyone who loved him. I didn't want to do that to the people who loved me. And so I got out of war reporting. And eventually I remarried, and I'm 62 years old. I have a 7-year-old girl and a 4-year-old girl. I have a family. I'm completely out of the war reporting business. My family, my daughters are the center of my life, and they're the reason I want to live as long as possible.
Sebastian, thank you for that reintroduction. Not that all of our listeners needed it, but I think it's helpful to level set. Let me set the conditions for this. As you know, this is not a book review podcast, right? This happens to be the world's largest weekly leadership podcast. And we discuss a broad variety of topics. Typically, our guests have written a book, but not always. And I mention that because you were gracious enough, as was your publisher, to send me copies of your book in a galley copy format. And I oftentimes will have the entire book read by the time our guest comes on. Sometimes it's impossible. We have 5 interviews this week. I can't read all the books. I intended to read your book cover to cover because compared to some of your books, In My Time of Dying is a shorter book. And so I started reading your book a couple of days ago. And in full transparency, I will tell you, our listeners, I didn't make it through. Not because of my lack of time management or of my discipline, but because at page 35, I almost passed out. I was reading the book in my bed, and I had to put it down because it was so jarring. It was extraordinarily well written. You know this. It was riveting. It was about your own near-death experience and how you came really face-to-face with, to quote you, the idea of an afterlife. I put the book down. I got up out of bed. I got a cup of water, walked around, regained my blood pressure, and made it through 7 more pages, had to put it back down. So in confession to you and our guest, you obviously survived because here you are, but I don't know what happened in the last 2/3 of this book. But I do know what happened in the first third, and that is I'm gonna invite you to slowly and maybe deliberately reorient our listeners and viewers to why you wrote this book, what happened in the beginning, and I made it as far as you being conscious in the hospital, them basically jamming a catheter into your neck, which is where I almost passed out. And I want you to tell the story up to there. Recognize we want everyone to buy the book. But what I found riveting in that first section was what you saw going on in the hospital room on the left side of your body with your father and on the right side of your body with the attendants. Would you maybe set the stage, tell the story up to that point, and then we'll stop, take a breath. I'll still be sitting here upright, hopefully, and then we'll go on.
Yes, of course. So I have to start by saying I'm an atheist. My father was an atheist and a physicist. I, in my life, have had no inclination towards the mystical, the woo-woo, anything like that. I'm a complete rationalist. And those ideas of mine were challenged by this experience, which is the short answer for why I wrote the book. So I, after years of covering front lines, almost getting killed a few times, I decided to stop war reporting. And what I found was that the front lines came to me. I thought I was now beyond the sort of reach of sudden death, right? We're all going to go eventually of something. I'm very healthy. I run a lot. I box. I got a great heart, et cetera. I'm not the kind of guy who's going to drop dead of a heart attack. And so I never thought I would need an emergency trip to the ER to save my life. It never crossed my mind. And we were living during COVID in a very remote house in the woods in Massachusetts. It's a 1-hour transport to the nearest hospital. We live at the end of a dead-end dirt road with no cell service. And the landline doesn't work when it rains because the line shorts out. It's an old line. So that's just to set the scene. So one afternoon, there were some teenage girls who lived up the street, a family that we knew, And they were babysitting for our little girls. And my wife and I had just like a few hours in the afternoon to just chill out a bit. It was a rare opportunity. Again, this was during COVID. And so my wife and I went out to this little cabin that we have even deeper into the woods. And it was a lovely June afternoon just to spend some time, right? And we were there. And in mid-sentence, we were just chatting. And in mid-sentence, I felt this pain shoot through my abdomen, quite intense pain. And I couldn't make it go away. I thought it was indigestion or something. I couldn't make it, no matter what position I went into, it wouldn't go away. So I stood up to see if I could sort of walk it out. And I almost fell over. And I sat back down and I said to my wife, I'm going to need help. I've never felt anything like this. I was very, very lightheaded and I couldn't stand on my own. So my wife, she got me onto her shoulder and she sort of half dragged me out of the cabin and through the woods. And she couldn't call for help because there's no cell signal. And we got to the dirt driveway and she put me in the passenger seat of the car and then ran in to tell the babysitters, like, something's wrong with Sebastian. We need to call the ambulance. You have to take care of the girls. I don't know what's happening, right? And so I was in and out of consciousness at this point. And although I didn't know that. And one of the girls came out and managed to get one bar of signal on her cell phone. She was sort of walking around in the driveway and she caught one bar of signal and called 911. And the ambulance came. And meanwhile, I'm in the car seat and I'm going blind. What was happening was that I had an undiagnosed aneurysm in my pancreatic artery. Now, an aneurysm is a ballooning of the blood vessel. It's not high cholesterol. It's not all that heart stuff. It's just a weak spot in an artery that over the course of your life can get bigger and bigger. And if it gets too big, it will rupture. It's just like the ballooning of a bike tire that will eventually burst if there's a weak spot in a bike tire. So what had happened was the aneurysm had ruptured and blood was pouring into my abdomen. And I was losing a pint of blood. You have maybe 12 pints of blood in your body. I was losing a pint of blood every 10 or 15 minutes directly into my abdominal cavity. If I'd been stabbed in the stomach, it would have been the same thing, blood loss. But I would have known what the problem was, and the doctors would have known where to sort of put their finger, to plug the leak. But your abdomen is basically a huge bowl of spaghetti. If you have internal bleeding, the doctors have a very, very hard time figuring out where it's coming from. So the ambulance crew finally got there and they took me on the long ride to the hospital. And I had gone into compensatory shock. So what happens is your body realizes something bad's going on. It clamps down on all the things that you don't need to survive. You don't need blood flow in your legs, in your arms, in your intestines. It shuts down everything it doesn't need and pulls blood in your head and in your chest cavity, around your heart. And so my condition improved. I was clear-minded again. My vision came back. I'm like, okay, I have sort of belly pain, but I'm good. I'm fine. I wasn't worried at all. And right when we got to the hospital, I went off a cliff. Your body can only hold itself in compensatory shock for so long, and eventually it lets go. And it let go right as I got to the hospital. And suddenly I'm actively dying. I'm going into hemorrhagic shock. My body is convulsing. I'm in terrible, terrible distress. But I didn't know I was dying. And they wheeled me in. The doctors immediately knew, oh, this has to be some form of abdominal hemorrhage. My odds of surviving at that point were about 30%. And that's if you get to the hospital quickly. I mean, what I had is rare. And the odds of surviving about 30%. And that's if with a short transport time. My odds of surviving by the time I actually got to the hospital were very, very low. Thank God I didn't know that. And suddenly there's doctors all over me and they start trying to put a large gauge needle directly into my jugular through my neck. And which sounds like it'd be very painful. It's actually not. I didn't feel anything but some pressure. And so while they're sort of doing that, it's a procedure that takes a while. I'm lying in the trauma bay and suddenly below me and to my left, this black pit opens up and it's sort of infinitely, it's sort of infinitely huge and infinitely black, right? And it just swallows light. And it started to pull me in. And I started to panic. And I didn't know I was dying. I was probably 10 minutes from dead at that point, according to one doctor. I didn't know I was dying, but I knew I didn't want to go into the pit. And so as I'm sort of bracing myself for this, my dead father appears above me. And it was this, as if his energy was there. It's hard to describe. It wasn't quite sight. I don't know. It's hard to describe how I saw him, but he was above me to my left. And basically he communicated, it's okay. You don't have to fight it. You can come with me. I'll take care of you. I was horrified. In my mind, I'm like, you're dead. I'm alive. I'm not going anywhere with you. Like, we got nothing to talk about that, right? And I said to the doctor, because I'm still conversant, I said to the doctor, you have to hurry. You're losing me right now. I'm going. And then that's the last thing I remembered for a while. I was in and out of consciousness. I was not sedated because my vital signs were so low. They did a CAT scan. They saw that I was bleeding from somewhere in my abdomen. They sent me into the interventional radiology suite, where basically you're on a machine that gives a real-time X-ray video, basically. So you get a fair amount of radiation when you do that for any length of time. I had radiation burns on my back from it later. But that's just the risk that they take, because otherwise you're going to die, right? So they threaded a catheter, a flexible tube through in my groin into my vascular system, into my femoral artery, and then up the artery and around. And they eventually, it took them about 6 hours, but eventually they got the catheter to the site where the bleed was happening, and they plugged it with a coil. They embolized it and stopped the bleeding. Now, but I wasn't out of the woods yet. I'd lost probably 2/3 of my blood. I needed 10 units of blood to survive. And anytime you get a massive transfusion like that, you're at risk of all kinds of other things that can kill you. In fact, the more blood you get, the statistics show that the more blood you get, the more likely you are to die. Makes sense, actually. So that nightmare took most of the night. I was in and out of consciousness. I saw some very strange things. But then, blessedly, they finished. They took me up to the ICU. I briefly saw my wife on the way through, who went through hell because she spent 6 hours thinking she was going to lose her husband. The doctors were quite honest with her about what the risks were, what the stakes were. And then I woke up the next morning in the ICU. And of course, I had no idea what had happened. And the nurse said to me, "Wow, Mr. Younger, good morning. We almost lost you. You almost died last night. You're lucky to be alive. In fact, no one can believe you're alive." I was completely shocked. I had no idea. And then she left me, and I sat with that awful thought for quite a while, and just thinking about how my daughters almost lost their father, it really tormented me. And so she came back later, and I'll end with this for the moment. She came back an hour later. The nurse came back an hour later and said, "How are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I'm okay." And I was throwing up blood. I wasn't doing well at all. But I said, "Yeah, I'm doing okay. But what you said to me is terrifying. I had no idea I'd almost died." And she said, "Try this. Instead of thinking about it like something scary, try thinking about it like something sacred." And then she left again. And I sat there thinking about those words. And I took it to mean, and again, I'm an atheist. I took it to mean, and I love the word sacred. I think it's a beautiful word. It has many secular meanings that I'm happy to use it for. I took it to mean that I've been allowed to go to the precipice and to look over the edge into what we call the beyond, into whatever waits for us after death. And then I was allowed to come back. Most people aren't. What did I come back with? I'd gone to the ultimate front line. I'd been going to front lines my whole life, and coming back with information that I thought people needed. I'd gone to the ultimate front line. What did I come back with? And if I could answer that question, that for me was turning this terrible experience into something sacred. And by sacred, I mean of some value, some use for people, something that will allow them to live their lives with more dignity and less fear.
Sebastian, some of our listeners and viewers may think you just told us a story. You didn't. You told us a hundredth of the story. The book is called In My Time of Dying, How I Came Face to Face with the Idea of an Afterlife. Your book has been described as part medical drama, part searing autobiography, and part rational inquiry into the ultimate unknowable mystery. It's true. You do this masterful job of talking about what's going on with you personally, kind of first person, your wife, your family, your kids, the babysitters, the journey. You talk about some flashbacks on some other near-death experiences you have. You talk about the medical biology, what's going on in the room. In fact, it's at that point where I stopped. I called my wife, Stephanie, up to our bedroom, and I got my phone out, and I said, I need everybody's blood type. What is your blood type? We have three sons that are 10, 12, and 14. What is everybody's blood type? What is my blood type? And I put it in my phone under blood types. It just so happens that we don't know what one of our son's blood types are. It's not on his birth certificate for some reason. We got to find it today. Before we go on in the story, will you talk about one of the gifts that you give readers is the importance of understanding the risks and the benefits of blood transfusions and how important this is. And just talk a little bit about the medicine, if you will, the medical aspects of blood donation, how important it is, how fast it leaves your body. Go wherever you want to on that, because I found that enormously helpful as a father who was crippled and then motivated into some action last night.
Yeah, well, thank you. Well, I mean, without blood, we die, right? And I was 10 minutes from dying because of blood loss. My blood pressure was 60 over 40 when I got to the trauma bay, which is running on fumes. And my life was saved by 10 people, anonymous people, who gave their blood, who donated their blood. And the sort of the miracle of blood donation is that doctors cannot manufacture blood. It can only come from other people. It is one of the most essential tools in saving people's lives that there is. And if you give blood, your body will manufacture more and replace it within like a week or two. And donating blood is a virtually painless 1-hour experience. And it's actually one of the few opportunities we have in this very safe, very mechanized, very modern society. One of the few opportunities we have to be part of something greater than yourself. We're all people. We all need blood. We're part of this wonderful society, this wonderful country. And fathers and mothers and children, soldiers, firemen, teachers, everybody who is in a medical crisis, they survive often because someone else donated blood and that saves their life. So this is my pitch to everybody, like, please donate blood. And if you do, you might save a life, but also you give yourself this amazing chance to be part of something greater than yourself. And it actually feels very good. I always walk out of there a little lightheaded because that's what happens when you give blood, but sort of slightly euphoric as well. It's such a good feeling. So blood transfusion was developed throughout the course of the 20th century. And some people early on tried to transfuse themselves with blood from animals. It doesn't work very well. Sometimes it kills the person. If you transfuse human blood and if you get the blood type right, if you don't, it's not necessarily the end of the road, but it's bad. But if you get the blood type right, O positive to O positive, what have you, you instantly, blood is interchangeable. You instantly have a fighting chance again. And one of the things they started to do is to separate blood into its various components. They do that so they can store it more easily. It's a logistics. They separate blood into its components to store it. Actually, whole blood coming from another person is actually the most effective way of transfusing blood. And they found that on the battlefields of Afghanistan and Iraq. And so the science is still developing. But it's absolutely crucial to saving life. And when I got there, they called a code red, which is a blood emergency. So they have to mobilize within the hospital all of these assets, nurses and technicians and doctors, to make sure that they get the right blood components and the right blood type from wherever they store that, wherever they store that stuff. It's sort of refrigerator temperature, I think, you know, into your body. And so they mobilize, you know, quite a number of people. And there's a sort of daisy chain of, okay, confirming, O positive for Sebastian Younger. Yes, O positive for Sebastian. You know, they and every packet of blood that goes into you, the doctor has to sign off on. It's a very rigorous process because the stakes are extremely high. But it changed medicine. It's almost miraculous, and it saved many, many lives. And one of the dangerous things about a long ambulance ride is that they can give you saline solution, but they cannot give you blood. And had they been able to give me blood in the ambulance, I wouldn't have come close to dying, but they couldn't do that. And they're actually working on the technology to see if they can give blood in ambulances, but they're not there yet.
In fact, Sebastian, I believe that in the ambulance, you actually asked the medic to give you more saline or something like that, and he refused. And you knew of that from your days in war reporting. And talk about the consequence of his decision not to do that as it relates to like the viscosity, the coagulation. I'm making words up, but give us a little more on that, and then we'll get back into the book.
Yeah, so he gave me a bag of saline, which was correct. It increases your blood volume. So even though the red blood cells are not, red blood cells transport oxygen. So even though they're not, even though you've lost red blood cells, you still need to keep volume up so that your heart doesn't have to work too hard to keep your system pressurized. If you give too much saline, it can trigger other problems, something called acidosis, which is quite complicated. I'm not sure I even entirely understand it myself, but acidosis can also kill you. So they have to be very careful with the saline solution. Had he given me another IV bag of blood, I would have had double the risk. It would have doubled my risk of acidosis, and it might not have ended well. And so the whole trick is to keep up blood volume during the transport. Now, because I'm a runner, I have a strong, healthy heart, and they were monitoring my. They didn't realize the ambulance crew did not realize I was bleeding out into my abdomen because my heart rate was quite normal. And that didn't make sense. Usually, if you're losing blood, the heart rate goes up to keep your system pressurized. But my heart was beating normally, so they ruled out blood loss. They ruled out internal hemorrhage because my heart was at 70 or 80 or whatever. And that was because I have a strong, healthy heart, which in the end saved my life. But it threw them off course in the diagnosis.
Sebastian, as an avowed atheist still, talk about the part of this book that you've written around how you came face to face with the afterlife after perhaps that initial experience with the black hole in your father. What happened beyond that?
Well, so now I'm in the ICU and I'm lying there trying to digest this news that I'd almost died. And almost immediately I remembered seeing my dead father and the pit. And I didn't understand. I mean, I couldn't explain it. You know, it came back to me. I'm like, oh my God, I saw my father last night. He was right there. He was trying to comfort me. He was inviting me. He was offering to sort of escort me into the next, whatever it is. And so of course, and the subtitle is quite carefully worded, I don't know if I came face to face with the afterlife because I can't know if there is one. And I certainly can't prove there is one. But I definitely came, as an atheist, came face to face with the idea of one, the concept of one. And my book is an attempt to explain in rational terms what I saw and what the explanations might be. Sometimes people say to me, so, you know, are you still an atheist? And because religious people, I can just say as an atheist, when religious people find out you're atheist, they're constantly trying to like convert you, like, oh, come on, you know, clearly God exists or there wouldn't be a universe. Like they have all kinds of arguments for why you should be a believer. And so someone like me is a prime target. Like, oh, you saw your dead father? Well, what about now? Are you an atheist now? And I am. And my answer is the afterlife, and that's in quotes, because I don't know that it exists, but the afterlife and God are not synonymous. They're not the same thing. You could have a creator God who created this amazing universe and populated it with completely biological beings like ourselves who, when they die, are completely dead forever and there's no afterlife. It's entirely possible, right? Or you could have a completely physical universe with biological beings like ourselves who, when they die, continue on in some quantum form. And quantum physics is the realm of physics that deals with the subatomic reality, right? That's smaller than atoms. And quantum laws rule the universe. And there are some theories that quantum information is never lost, and that a human being, or maybe any conscious life, is a form of quantum information, and that after you die, that quantum information persists in a way that retains some identity of what used to be a person. And that maybe that's what I encountered on this threshold, where I was going from a biological being transitioning into sort of quantum information. And it, you know, you can't prove this, you can't disprove it. It's a thought experiment. But it's one that does not have obvious answers or an obvious refutation. And so in terms of the atheist question, that's how I sort of parse it out. You could have a God and an afterlife, or you could have no God and some kind of afterlife. You could have both, you could have neither. Like they're not dependent on each other, and they don't have to occur together or not occur together. They're really separate things.
Sebastian, for those who know you, are aware that you're a tough dude. I mean, you have seen likely drama and trauma and hell on earth and all of your reporting around the world. You've gone through something that is unrelatable to most of us. This book, in light of that, is actually extremely courageous, because no doubt you know you're going to place yourself in the middle of a lot of conversation. Well, how can you still be an atheist? Or you're going to spark a debate, a conversation around what you are missing or what you saw. I'm sure you are prepared for that. What was your hope in writing this book? It's a very vulnerable book because you've not converted to, you know, some religion, nor I'm suggesting you should have, but you've sort of stayed steadfast in your belief, but you've put yourself out there to say something unique happened to me. I can separate the afterlife from God or a creator or religion. That's going to certainly spark a conversation. What's your intention with this being your next book?
Well, it's a continuation of all of my journalism. I mean, journalism often engages in very controversial topics. I mean, just open the newspaper and you're reading controversy on every page, practically. And journalists, they're valuable for many reasons, but one is because they at least try to bring an objective perspective to very, very complicated problems. And society is constantly having to make decisions about how to protect itself, how to run a just and fair and safe society. And you need journalism to report on those stories. And you don't necessarily want journalists to come to their own opinions. Journalism is not about opinions, even though you might have them privately. You don't want to sort of show your hand when you're reporting for all people about complicated topics. So, for example, when I was covering what has been termed a genocide in Bosnia, there was some real debate about whether a humanitarian intervention, in other words, an armed intervention that would stop the war, if that was justified or not. And eventually NATO forces, spearheaded by the United States and Britain, bombed Serb positions around Sarajevo. And then again, they did that during the ethnic cleansing of Kosovo, to stop the war. And, you know, in my personal opinion, it was a good thing. I would never write that in an article. What I wrote were articles about this intractable problem and what are the options for doing for stopping it, diplomatic, military, what have you. And so I did the same thing with this. I mean, I had my subjective first-person perspective, which was enormously clouded by, you know, low blood oxygen and what some people would call hallucinations and all kinds of other things. It's valuable and it's interesting, but it's not necessarily the whole reality. So I also interviewed all the doctors that I could who saved my life about what was going on with me while I was experiencing this strange thing, right? And then I did a lot of research and interviewed a lot of people about what are called near-death experiences. And there are many researchers and scientists and some doctors who believe that near-death experiences of the sort that I had show that there is an afterlife. You know, it's a rather optimistic interpretation, but that's their belief. And so I looked through all the literature and I interviewed people that believe that. And why do you believe that? Why, you know, what do we believe and why? What are the rational reasons for believing what we believe? And then I looked at all the literature that sort of refutes that reasoning and says, no, it's not proof of an afterlife. We know that the brain, when deprived of oxygen, will have hallucinations. And if you have epileptic fits, you sometimes see a light at the end of a tunnel and all these other things that people who almost die also report. The refutation is, we can reproduce all of this in the lab, right? The human brain, the neurology is subjected to these forces and will react in certain ways. That's all NDEs are. But then in the spirit of inquiry and impartiality, what I found, again, without coming to a firm conclusion, but the question that I found, and what I will concede in terms of my atheism, is that I used to be a certain atheist. Now I'm an uncertain one, meaning that my mind has been open to the idea that not only do I not know, that the ultimate truth about the universe can't even be known by humans. It's possible it is just beyond our capacity to understand, as is the beginning of the universe. We know what happened within milliseconds of the Big Bang, but we don't know why the Big Bang happened in the first place. It may be beyond our knowledge. So likewise, life and death, it may just be beyond our knowledge to understand if there is anything beyond our biological death. And so the big question that really opened this up for me, that may be a sort of questioning atheist, is that many, many dying people, myself included, one of the things they see, they don't just have hallucinations, right? One of the things they see are the dead. And typically the dead come to help the dying person across the threshold. And this has been documented hundreds, thousands of times from societies around the world. And there's documentation about this throughout the ages. And so what we know is that if you give a room full of people LSD, they will all hallucinate, right? We know how that works in the brain, right? We know exactly how that works. But they will not all hallucinate the same thing, right? The dying hallucinate the dead, and no one else in the room sees the dead. And hospice nurses are constantly reporting this, that the dying person that they're taking care of in their last hours and even day or two, they see the dead in the room and they're even talking with them. And no one else can see them. And there are even cases, quite a few actually, of the dying person being visited by a dead person who had just died. And the dying person didn't know that this person had just died. And yet there they are. And so there is really a bit of a mystery. And that's where, in my book, it's divided into two sections, what and if. The what deals with what happened to me. The if section is, what if there were something more than just our biological existence that continued on after death? Almost in my words in the book, almost certainly that's not the case, right? I hedge my bets with the rationalists. But just as a thought experiment, if that were the case, how would it work? Like, how could that conceivably work within the sort of guardrails of science as we know it? And so obviously I don't come to a firm conclusion, but I do play out as far as we can in legitimate scientific terms how that might conceivably work.
Sebastian, I think the measure of a great podcast is when the host says virtually nothing and the guest talks the entire time, and you've confirmed my hypothesis. I could listen to you for hours. I'm mindful of our time. Last question. On a lighter note, you are an acclaimed author and broad range of topics, riveting topics. This book is written in a fascinating way because you tease together not plot lines, but you've written this autobiography, this sort of memoir of an incident with this sort of existential exploration. You've put together a compendium of medical facts and data and interesting, applicable knowledge and language, vernacular for our lives. It's a call to action for many of us to kind of take stock of our spirituality, of our life on earth, of a call to action to donate blood and to become more aware of that. It's all that kind of teased together. How do you come up with your strategy, your architecture, your framework when you write books? I'm asking from an author to an author, speaking to millions of people who either are writing or authoring. What would you teach us about how you architect?
So first of all, if you talk about technical material, scientific material, I mean, if you're writing about reality, you had better be doing some of that because we need some basis for our opinions and our beliefs. But if you're doing that, keep in mind that even if you write with amazing clarity and very, very compelling sentences and paragraphs and ideas, people, understandably, really can only take a few pages of that at a time. And if you keep going for too long, they start to zone out. And so out of respect for your own material and the sort of attention span and the comfort of not only the average reader, but even really, really switched on readers, you want to make those sections quite short and then return to it if you need to. But you want to be going back and forth between the sort of the human part of the brain, which responds to sort of good storytelling, good human stories, that part of the reader's brain, and the sort of more analytical, data-driven, information-driven part of the reader's brain. You want to keep toggling back and forth between those two because they're both important. Without the human stories, we might not bother to read about blood transfusion technology or whatever. And without the technical part, the human stories are just that. They're human stories. And they don't have a firm sort of foundation, factual basis. They're not rooted in something factual and demonstrably true. So you want to pay attention to that toggling back and forth of those two kinds of information. And also, you just have to conceive of the whole book as a kind of narrative arc. And we watch narrative arcs all the time. Every time you watch a movie, someone has thought about how to play with the level of tension, with when you reveal things, when you conclude things, when you reach an epiphany, a dramatic moment, and then you go back to something quieter. You movies do that all the time, and they hold our interest for a couple of hours. You have, as a writer, you have to do the same thing, and you have to conceive of the entire work in this sort of dramatic arc, and that's what will keep people reading through until the end, and unless they get lightheaded and have to get a drink of water.
Sebastian, very few podcasts have a 6-year run, and sometimes I'll admit I get fatigued and think maybe I should sunset this and go do something else. I do other things, and then it comes along an interview like yours that reinvigorates me to keep sharing stories. Your book is In My Time of Dying, How I Came Face to Face with the Idea of an Afterlife. Sebastian Younger, thank you for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you very much.
And we'll see you back here, hopefully, next week for a new episode of On Leadership.